Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. We've been living with and dying from COVID-19 for more than 2 years. Around the world, more than 5.5 million people are dead from the virus, something that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. As we head into the third year of the pandemic, the death toll continues to rise.
The United States passing 800,000 deaths.
This year's COVID-19 death toll is higher than last year.
Today, West Virginia joined 36 other states who have the Omicron variant of COVID-19.
The Omicron variant is more transmissible than the Delta variant. And
officials in West Virginia are bracing for a potential surge.
The first case of Omicron variant is from an unvaccinated resident.
Unvaccinated people are driving this new surge.
This Omicron virus is surely sweeping across this land.
The fact that this virus can bounce between vaccinated individuals and unvaccinated individuals can lead to rise of variants that are resistant to those of us who are vaccinated and boosted.
West Virginia has seen some of the sharpest increases in the country.
5,288 deaths in West Virginia. So we knew it was coming. Well, how do we stop it? What do we do?
We focus on vaccinations. After researchers and scientists created the vaccine, it was time to sell the public health campaign. Early on, West Virginia's governor, Jim Justice, like many politicians, focused his energy on mass vaccination efforts to stop the spread of the virus. However, convincing people to get vaccinated is no small task.
The United States is 40th in vaccination rates across the world, which is really inexcusable.
Today, just a little more than 40% of eligible West Virginians are fully inoculated.
Governor Jim Justice is begging residents to get their COVID vaccine.
You've got to absolutely hear me when I say you need to be vaccinated so badly. You cannot sit around and not get this done.
Convincing younger people remains a challenge.
The 5,256 death of 31-year-old from Raleigh County. I think, my gosh, how tragic is this? We're not going to quit trying. We're not going to just lay down and be frustrated and say, oh, you know, we got a lot of people out there that won't listen at all. And so we're just not going to do anything. That's not the answer. That's not the answer at all.
So then, what is the answer? How do you convince people who are still not fully vaccinated to get their shots? What message do you send them? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them, the show that looks at the issues that divide us. I'm Trey Kay. When COVID-19 vaccinations first became available to the general public, the West Virginia vaccination program was one of the most successful in the United States. Then, in late spring 2021, the vaccination numbers in West Virginia hit a wall. Vaccination rates plummeted. In an effort to jumpstart the stalled vaccination program, Governor Jim Justice turned to an age-old solution familiar to advertisers and consumers: cash and prizes. Following the lead of a similar campaign in Ohio, Governor Justice launched the West Virginia Vaccine Lottery Incentive Program.
I'm proud of how West Virginians have fought through this terrible pandemic of COVID-19. In order for us to be able to continue to run across the finish line, all of us have got to get vaccinated. It's safe, it's free. We've got to get more of us vaccinated. We're coming out with a new incentive program. We're giving away college scholarships, souped-up pickup trucks, and we're going to make many West Virginians millionaires. But you have to get vaccinated first in order to win. Go now to vaccinate.wv.gov.
During the PR campaign for the state's vaccine lottery, Governor Justice decided to double down and deploy another of advertising's age-old enticements, cute animals. The governor appeared in a now well-known news conference with his English bulldog named Baby Dog.
I brought my little buddy with me today. If she won't make you smile, I can't make you smile. All right, now listen, if you won't do it for me, if you won't do it for your family, you've got to get vaccinated for Baby Dog. That's all there is to it. She wants you vaccinated. I want you vaccinated. And I want a bunch of you to win all this stuff and everything. And that'd be just great. But I'm telling you, and she's telling you too, go get yourself vaccinated right now. Right, baby? Thank y'all so much.
And so the West Virginia Vaccine Incentives Program became known as the Do It for Baby Dog campaign. According to the most obvious metric, name recognition and public awareness, the campaign was a massive success. People throughout the state of West Virginia and throughout the country heard the baby dog message loud and clear. But according to the most important metric, which is how many people actually got vaccinated because of the campaign, the results were not so clear. In fact, some people question whether the incentives worked at all. In the summer of 2021, Mountain State Spotlight reporter Ian Carville published an article examining the effectiveness of the Baby Dog campaign.
So it was based on a campaign in Ohio, which I think was the nation's first vaccine lottery campaign. After the vaccine lottery campaign rolled out there, the vaccination numbers went up. And so it got a lot of national coverage. And while that was getting a bunch of press coverage, Jim Justice announced the Do It for Baby Dog lottery in West Virginia. And we just didn't see that same bump in vaccination numbers.
West Virginia's lottery wasn't as successful as the vaccination lottery in Ohio. And that convinced many public health researchers to look deeper into the data. And when they did, they discovered that, as with most things, context is key.
When everyone was saying, hey, look, Ohio's vaccination numbers are going up in the 18 and over population, the start of that lottery had coincided with when the CDC cleared the vaccination for use in teenagers. So in states all over the country, you were seeing a similar bump, which is presumably parents bringing their teenagers to get vaccinated and going, you know what, I might as well get one while I'm here. Or, you know, now this thing's been around for a while, so let's finally do this. You know, whatever variation of that it is.
The West Virginia Vaccine Lottery did produce a small uptick in vaccination numbers. But once again, timing and context are key. The results in the Mountain State were in line with the news-driven vaccination trends nationwide.
There actually was a slight change around the time that he announced the first winners. And that got a lot of publicity. I mean, you know, he was handing out giant dog bone-shaped checks and trucks. But that bump also coincided with the beginning of a lot of reporting on the Delta variant in the United States. And you saw something similar around the country. It was like a few days or a week behind when you look at the bump, but it was something very similar that people started hearing about that, getting nervous and getting vaccinated more. I know he is very fond of pointing out how many people got vaccinated as a result of the campaign, which is just how many people have been vaccinated since I announced this campaign, which is, it's assuming causation, to put it mildly.
Are you saying that the governor often would say, I started this campaign at this time, and look how many people have gotten vaccinated, and this is why?
He likes doing that a lot. And, you know, how many people have been vaccinated in more than 6 months? I mean, it's going to be a pretty significant number. But yeah, I mean, after this article came out, I remember, I mean, he just like went on a rant at one of his press conferences saying anyone who's rooting against the Do It for Baby Dog campaign, which at least I'm definitely not, I mean, I would want it to succeed, is rooting for death and like really railing on reporters who are asking him hard questions. It was weird. When all it was just questioning, hey, is this the most effective way to be spending this federal money? You know, now that there is data.
Ian Carbell's reporting makes it clear that West Virginia's vaccine lottery was a well-intentioned campaign to combat the most serious public health threat we've faced in generations, and that Governor Jim Justice should be commended for the effort. However, government resources to fight the pandemic are limited. So the question becomes, is this the best way to spend our money?
Look, I mean, if this convinced just a few people to get a vaccine, can you call it a failure? Like, no. I mean, I think it's fantastic if that happened, and I hope it did often. But the way that I tried to measure it was just looking at West Virginia and the weekly average shots, and then comparing that to similar numbers in the country at large, which did not have a big lottery. If the trends, you know, the dips and bumps in vaccination were pretty much exactly the same, and the number stayed really stagnant for most of the months of the Do It for Baby Dog campaign's existence, then that may not be effective. And, you know, I also, like, I didn't just rely on my own analysis either. I mean, I talked to statisticians who were studying this. And since then, there have been even more peer-reviewed studies that have come out, which have found that vaccine lotteries have not been a particularly effective incentive. And again, that's not to say it wasn't a good idea. Like, try everything. It's just once those statistics have been measured and the campaign isn't working, you know, it's kind of curious that that is the only thing West Virginia continues to do to incentivize people to get vaccines and spend millions of dollars on that when there are other options.
Although Ian Carbell's research suggests that incentive programs such as West Virginia's vaccine lottery do not produce statistically significant results, we decided to look a little deeper and consider how successful such public health campaigns have been against other disease outbreaks. For example, the global HIV/AIDS epidemic of the 1980s faced many of the same public health messaging challenges as today's COVID pandemic.
My name is Monica Gandhi. I'm a professor of medicine and an infectious disease doctor at UCSF.
Dr. Gandhi's career at the University of California, San Francisco has been focused on her work with HIV/AIDS patients. Dr. Gandhi has extensive firsthand experience with incentive programs as a tool to control the spread of HIV, and she has very clear opinions about their effectiveness.
Incentives in the setting of HIV are actually quite common, both for prevention and for treatment. It's not used in every setting. I work with a vulnerable population that's low income because I work with uninsured patients, and we use incentives quite often. In general, in the world of conditional incentives and also what's called contingency management for substance use, they're quite effective. So going to just HIV, there have been many studies that show us that once people are engaged in care, they do have to be engaged in care. If you give them conditional incentives, they have longer periods of virologic suppression, staying on therapy, taking their medications. It has to be incentives they want. So money, frankly, is helpful, or gift cards. So something that they really want and of enough value that it really incentivizes someone to take the medication.
Can I just go ahead and assume that you believe that incentive measures could work in expanding vaccinations for people who are hesitant to get the vaccination?
I do, actually. And I don't think it's the incentive measures that we've used so far, because there was a lot of incentives used. There was come and get your free this, come and get your free food item. There was get a lottery ticket, but you may not win that lottery. But I kind of go back to remembering my patients with HIV. It's very helpful to have financial remuneration frankly. It's either in the form of petty cash, we give them money, or we give them gift cards. I would give people a relatively sizable amount to get COVID-19 vaccinated, like $250, maybe $500, literally something quite sizable to do it. The reason is that I think we didn't use incentives in the right way. We really have tried incentives, but I don't think they were the right incentives.
And when you're saying give them money, are you suggesting that in the long run, it's going to be cost effective?
Yes. Look how much money we're spending on items that we wouldn't have needed right now if we had better vaccine uptake. We wouldn't have had the hospitalizations of the unvaccinated if we had better uptake of the vaccines in the Delta and the Omicron surge. It would be very cost effective to give people $500 for their vaccine series who are still on the fence, along with the information about how safe the vaccines are together, and see if that would help our vaccine uptake. I've gone up to 500, you notice. I just decided it was 500.
It might seem simple. Get a few vaccinations and win a prize or cold hard cash. As the coronavirus continues to mutate and expand, its fatality rate can be devastating, especially to unvaccinated people. So what prevents someone from getting a vaccine? Dr. Gandhi says our current vaccination efforts have stalled because of misinformation about the safety and effectiveness of our vaccines. This creates an atmosphere of mistrust, which prevents vaccine acceptance.
It's both inherent mistrust, I think, in the American people, maybe rugged individualism or whatever that it is about the American psyche. And then second is that we earn some of that distrust. The misinformation is real, like meaning people really do tell people that these aren't safe vaccines when there isn't evidence for that. And those people who tell them can have MDs after their names and appear very convincing. And so I think it's very scary to people. And putting that all together, we are not where we should be with vaccine uptake.
As Dr. Gandhi sees it, our inability to create an atmosphere of trust means the best way to combat our stagnating vaccination numbers is with cold hard cash.
There is an us and them mentality, a fear-based, a more shame stigma-based approach. I'm telling you something about the US. This is why I want to cut through all the noise and give people $500. I really do. Just to please, I promise they're safe. Here's the information on it, and here's your $500. It cuts through everything.
In terms of public health messaging, how should public health organizations frame their pitch to the unvaccinated?
I would say, if I were the public health organization, I would say, I am sorry that you've heard misinformation. We now have 1 year of data that these vaccines are extremely safe. 63% of Americans have been vaccinated. We have been giving out in the world billions of doses of vaccines, and people are doing well. I would like to give you some financial incentive to please take the vaccine, because I understand why you were on the fence before now, because it was very confusing, but we really think they're safe. And we thank you for performing this service for the rest of the country and taking this vaccine. And here's $500.
You're still holding at 500. You're not going to increase
it. I have an amount. I suddenly have an amount, because I'm just thinking about how much we're spending right now. So 500, I think, is worth it.
Some might argue that sounds like a lot of money at a time when we seem to have hit the peak of the Omicron variant. Dr. Gandhi believes the benefits of $500 vaccine incentives would outweigh the costs.
We're not through Omicron yet. We could announce it tomorrow and more people would get vaccinated, I guarantee you. It's going to help hospitals even to get people one dose. I'm telling you it will. And I would do it tomorrow.
As we've reported many times on this show, West Virginia is no stranger to the public health impacts of HIV/AIDS. The opioid crisis has boosted intravenous drug use in the state, and that's resulted in many West Virginians becoming infected with HIV. We decided to compare Dr. Gandhi's opinions about vaccine incentives with those of a public health professional right here in the Mountain State.
I'm Judith Feinberg. I'm an infectious diseases physician by training. I am a researcher as well as clinician and educator. And For the majority of my career, my focus was in HIV disease.
Dr. Feinberg is a professor of behavioral medicine and psychology at the West Virginia University School of Medicine. Before that, she worked in Ohio and established one of the state's first needle exchange programs. Its goal was to prevent HIV spread through drug use and to encourage patients to go into treatment. I began by asking Dr. Feinberg if financial incentives could work as a means of encouraging people infected with HIV to seek treatment.
I don't think that would work at all, frankly. I think over time, you develop a bond of trust, and then when people are ready to deal with whatever it is they want to deal with, they'll come to you. My experience is that once that bond of trust was there, people would come in and say, help me.
I'm trying to see if there are any similarities between the challenges of expanding HIV treatment and expanding COVID-19 vaccinations.
It's the same thing, I think, Trey. Every time you're talking about something that you can see is, from a health perspective, advantageous to somebody, you have to find a way for them to incorporate it in their personal hierarchy of needs. Like, this is important to me. If it's not important to you, there's no amount of cajoling or gift cards or gas cards or $10 or $20. There's no amount of that that's going to make a difference if it's not really important to you. You could be in the throes of your substance use disorder, but if it were important enough to you personally, you could seek HIV care. The issue is, how do you make it important enough to someone to do that? And I don't know the answer to that. That's magic.
Dr. Feinberg does agree with Dr. Gandhi on one important point. They both worry about the unprecedented degree to which social and political forces have eroded our trust in public health experts and the messaging on the COVID vaccine.
The sad thing about COVID, it has assumed a political dimension that it just shouldn't have, right? It's an infectious disease. You know, and like infectious diseases, there are ways you catch it. There are ways you try to prevent catching it. There are ways to ameliorate it. There are ways to treat it. There's vaccination against it. But this has become so politicized. Political forces ran away with this so quickly. And I think typical public health messaging had no tools for this. This has never been experienced before. You know, for example, when I was a little girl, late 40s, early 50s, polio was a thing, right? People were really terrified. But we are not dealing with a world that looks at infection like that now. We're dealing with a world where to take this infection seriously means you belong to a political camp that some people want nothing to do with. But if you're asking me, how could I convince someone who, at the core of their current identity and being, thinks that this is a bad thing, right? That this is taking away their freedom, that this is whatever, however they see that for themselves, then I don't really know how to change that. I think it's a tremendous sorrow to me as an infectious disease doctor at a both individual health and public health level that we are not dealing with COVID as the infectious disease that it is. But instead, we're stuck in this morass of people using COVID as a way of validating their political view of the world.
This much is clear. We have a messaging problem, but no obvious messaging solution. So much in the same way as you would ask your doctor for medical advice, Dr. Feinberg suggests that we seek professional help to solve our messaging problem.
Probably got to be a different approach. But I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't know what that approach is. I bet you Madison Avenue could come up with something, you know, like if you can sell anything to anybody, you know, and then how do you sell vaccination and appropriate social behavior to people? I really wish I knew the answer to this, but I don't. And to me, it's every day it's just a tragedy that we don't have a better way of reaching people.
What are the potential impacts if these messaging campaigns are not effective?
We're going to see a lot more people get sick, go to the hospital, and die.
After a break, we'll hear from a West Virginian with experience on the front lines of the vaccination effort. She explains what effective messaging really looks like at this stage in the pandemic. And then we'll follow up on Dr. Feinberg's suggestion and speak with a Madison Avenue advertising professional. Is there a silver bullet solution to our stagnating vaccination efforts? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them. Our show is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Hey there, it's Trey, and from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them. Now, it really doesn't matter what you're selling, toothpaste or t-shirts, vacuum cleaners or vaccines. The first rule of any effective messaging campaign is know your audience. With regard to COVID-19 vaccination efforts in the state of West Virginia, I think there are few people who know the hearts and minds of West Virginians better than Lynn Fruth. Lynn is president of Fruth Pharmacy, a West Virginia family business and one of the largest pharmacy chains in the state. But Lynn's not just some executive hidden away in an office someplace. Throughout the pandemic, Lynn has been on the front lines as part of Fruth Pharmacy's COVID-19 testing and vaccination programs. Over the course of the pandemic, Lynn has formed some very clear opinions about the state of vaccination acceptance in West Virginia.
I divide the people into the hell no, never going to get it, no matter what. So that group of people, not going to take it. Then you've got the in-between people. The only people you can hope to capture are the vaccine hesitant, because the vaccine resistant, that ship has sailed, in my opinion. So we are seeing some of the vaccine-resistant people coming in and getting the vaccine because jobs, you know, in order to keep their employment, or just, you know, after Delta and they didn't get Delta, they're like, oh, okay, it's not a big deal. And then with this next big wave, we did see an uptick in people getting vaccinated. Because of, like, they finally just realized this thing is here. And now it's been a year since these other people got vaccinated and they're not all dropping dead. So, you know, the messaging for us has just been very difficult.
Based on her experience, Fruth believes the hell no anti-vax contingent in West Virginia is largely driven by religious and political concerns.
I think that there's basically two main drivers of why people aren't getting the vaccine. I mean, certainly the religious extremism, and I am very disappointed in the faith community that have not heavily promoted vaccines as a way to save lives. And a lot of them did. That said, there are some who have taken a pretty hard line against the vaccine, and so, you know, the real followers there are not wanting to get it. Then you have the Trump people who, you know, I believe one of the biggest disservices that he did during his presidency was all the remarks that he made, which early entrenched people to go away from getting vaccinated, even though he later got vaccinated. By then he'd lost those folks. And they were kind of mad that he got vaccinated, quite honestly. But he missed the greatest chance when he got it to just come out and say, oh my gosh, folks, this is real. I was very sick. I'm fortunate I got treated. I really need all you guys to go out and get vaccinated. No, I'm so strong. I'm so great, blah, blah, blah. So that was a lost cause.
As for the vaccine hesitant contingent, Fruth believes that they are driven by their concerns about the safety of the vaccine. However, she says their concerns are not supported by the results she's seen firsthand.
So I think there's a big contingency of people who are really afraid of what the risks are, what's going to happen. And we've done 40,000 shots at Fruth Pharmacy, 40,000 plus, probably going up on 50. And that's as many people as live in Charleston, for crying out loud. We've not had one single serious side effect, not one. So this isn't some guy living in New York City telling you there's no side effects. This is somebody who's telling you our company's done 40,000 vaccinations and not had any side effects. And that does resonate with people. You know, I'm not seeing or talking to people anecdotally who are saying, well, you know, I got the vaccine and I've had nothing but trouble since then. I'm talking to people who are saying, my mother died, my sister died, I had COVID and now I can't work. Those are the conversations that I'm having because of doing the testing and because of being out there in the public. It's like those kind of things where you're down there and you're talking to people who've lost loved ones. Those kind of conversations definitely move people more than, you know, you have to do it or whatever.
When it comes to the Do It for Baby Dog campaign, Lynn Fruth says that while Baby Dog is adorable, it's hard to find any evidence that she's been effective in her role as vaccine ambassador for the state of West Virginia.
Do It for Baby Dog? We love Baby Dog down here. You know, it would have been nice if it would have worked a little bit better. It didn't really seem to move the needle a lot. And I think that's unfortunate. You know, we saw a little bit of people are like, oh, I'll get it if I'm going to maybe win something. But it really did not have the impact that they thought it would. I don't know if you'd have given everybody $500 and they probably would have gone and done it. You know, we did some things where we offered $10 gift cards if you got the shot. And I will tell you, in some poor communities, we got some takers. You know, you get two shots, you get $20. Well, okay, I'm broke. I'll take the $20. But they probably weren't people that were drastically opposed to the vaccine. They probably just were people who hadn't really given it much thought or whatever.
As Lynn Fruth sees it, there's a primary obstacle facing any messaging campaign. Young people resistant to the vaccine have little, if any, experience with such a disease. They don't have the historical context they need to understand the risks of deadly infectious diseases because, well, we have vaccinations for them.
Most of the people who are very anti-vaxxers are not old enough to remember what a deadly disease measles was, what a deadly disease and horrible disease polio was. I remember being a child and my parents being excited because the polio vaccine was going to be available. Not that I knew that much at that young age, but I knew it was a big deal because of the way my parents were acting. But I also know people that had, you know, polio and still have the impacts of that. And my father had measles as a young man and almost died and ended up going blind for a period of time. So I've seen firsthand or understand firsthand the things that happened because of some of these diseases that we've essentially eradicated because, as my cardiologist said last week, Lynn, we all just lined up and took the shot. You know, they said, you're going to take the shot. Everybody got in line. You got the shot. Nobody said, I don't want to get the shot, or nobody's parents said, I don't want to get the shot. Your mom and dad said, get in the line. You're getting the shot. So we probably have too much free choice right now.
So in today's supercharged political environment, how do you persuade the unvaccinated people to get on board and get a shot? Well, in Lynn Fruth's opinion, you gotta get them where they live.
The impact of COVID has been felt in families. I will tell you this, no one seems to care that the healthcare system is overwhelmed. That's their job. A lot of people, I'm sure, just think that's their job. They're just a bunch of whiners. That messaging hasn't really moved anybody, but pretty much everybody cares about their family. Talking about the impact of COVID on a family is probably the right messaging. From a loss or hardship, you know, kids without parents, parents who can no longer work because of long COVID. So it's kind of that do it for somebody else. I don't think that we're going to get people to do it for themselves anymore. It's, you know, who do you want to protect? Do it so your baby has a mother. Do it so your children don't lose a parent. I mean, to me, that's a pretty compelling message. If you don't care enough about your grandma to do it, you know, do you want to leave your kids without a parent?
Fruth is not only certain about the message we should send, she's also very clear-eyed about the medium we should use to send it.
I feel like at this point in time, we're down to hand-to-hand combat. It's going to be one person having a conversation. And I know that Drew, our pharmacist who's been interviewed a lot, had a gentleman in his social circle, a father of one of the kids that his son is friends with, who was very strong anti-vaxxer, and Drew just kept working on him. And I think it was probably after one of these waves came out that this man called him and said, okay, I'm going to get it. Drew got in his car and drove over there right that day so that he wouldn't change his mind. But that's kind of where we are. We are in the one-on-one physicians talking to patients. And that's the conversation I had with my personal physician a couple weeks ago was, it's one-on-one. How do you get someone to consider changing their position?
Fruth says it's clear that the lingering pandemic is creating tension in our communities, which can get the better of even the most reasonable folks. She has heard unvaccinated people give all sorts of reasons for why COVID takes some lives and not others. When someone talks about pre-existing conditions, here's what she has to say.
They all had other conditions, and you know what I say to that? Yes, they did. But they used to be alive, and now they're dead. Once again, used to be alive, now dead. Any questions? Quite honestly, I'm to the point where I'm like, y'all don't want to get vaccinated? Whatever. Do it, don't do it. If you get sick, that's on you. I mean, most of the people are sort of over it. The vaccinated people are really getting frustrated with the unvaccinated people.
At this point, with no easy solution to our messaging problems in sight, we decided to call a professional. This public health campaign to convince the American people to get their COVID vaccinations is a job for Madison Avenue.
My name's Ty Montague. I am one of the founders and co-CEOs of a company called CoCollective. We call ourselves a creative and strategic transformation partner for purpose-led businesses. We help leadership teams define and align on the higher purpose that they want to pursue in the world, something that has generosity at the core of it, something that transcends, you know, just making a lot of money. And then we help them operationalize that purpose in a variety of ways, in their customer experience, in their internal employee experience. And we also do any, you know, additional brand architecture work or brand strategy work to help them make it real in the world. My background is advertising. I would say I'm pretty much out of that business now. You know, we don't do a lot of advertising. Our thesis, we call it story doing as opposed to storytelling. So I was in the storytelling business for, I don't know, 20 or 25 years. Loved it. It's a great business. But, you know, back in the day, it just felt like ads were becoming a little bit less relevant and actually a little bit less effective at attacking the kind of problems that we're going to talk about today.
Just for context, it's important to understand that when Ty Montague says his background is in advertising, he's being modest, to say the least. His resume includes assignments as chief creative officer at some of the most prestigious and awarded ad agencies in the world. Ad Age named him as one of the 50 most influential creatives in advertising. So let's just say he's highly qualified to discuss messaging to the masses. Montague began our conversation by pointing out the challenges involved with any and all messaging campaigns.
The most important thing to creating any effective method of behavior change, let's call it, is to understand the existing behavior as well as you possibly can and the motivations behind the existing behavior, and then design a way to change that behavior, hopefully by showing people a way forward or a better way. People don't like to change. Changing habits is really hard. In fact, it's the hardest thing to get a human being to do, is to change the way they think about the world and change the things that have become rote habit. So trying to get somebody to do something new is really hard.
The COVID vaccination campaign is swimming upstream because it's asking people to do something new. But Ty Montague says there's another challenge involved. It's about our lack of trust. Just like Dr. Gandhi and Dr. Feinberg, he says widespread social skepticism works against traditional media messaging campaigns.
One of the large themes going on, and I think it's certainly true of the good people of West Virginia, I think it's true well outside of West Virginia as well, is that we are experiencing a crisis of trust. You know, there's lots of data to show that trust has eroded in all of our major institutions, the government, companies, the church, and so
news media.
And so people are struggling right now to figure out where to get information that they can rely on. And even before all of this happened, the data showed clearly that advertising was one of the worst ways to try to convince somebody to change their behavior. The best way is on the recommendation of a friend. People trust people they know. And so that's what it's about. That is the coin of the realm, is personal recommendation from somebody that you know and trust.
But Montague says the baseline level of mistrust in our society has been amplified further by political forces and misinformation peddled on social media.
So you have this pandemic. The CDC and the medical community are not even aligned on the right course of action. So they tell us initially to wear masks, or actually not to wear masks. Masks are ineffective, was the original CDC point of view. Then they tell us to wear masks. Our last president then starts putting forth insane ideas like drinking or injecting bleach into your body to solve the problem. And then he and the folks on the right politicize it and create this narrative that it's about freedom, and resisting wearing a mask and resisting the vaccine is almost your American duty. And then our current president tries to mandate vaccines for all government workers and tries to convince companies to mandate them for all employees. And you kind of add into that mix social media, which is the ultimate amplifier of craziness. Literally, the way the algorithms work is they're designed to create engagement. And it turns out that the content that people want to engage with the most is content that is polarizing, outrageous, in some cases ridiculous, but it creates high levels of engagement, which is all that Facebook and Twitter really care about. That is the one metric to rule them all. And so people struggle to find, you know, the truth. So I have real compassion, actually, for vaccine doubters. It's not actually that outrageous to be concerned about the vaccine. And that's why I say, into this environment, I don't know that you can launch any ad campaign that is suddenly going to have people sit up and go, okay, that's the truth.
If somebody like Governor Justice would have come to you and said, look, my hair is on fire here. I've got to figure out a way to lead my state, and I don't know exactly what to do. I'm going to try this ad. It may seem like throwing spaghetti on the wall and seeing if it sticks or not, but this is what I think is the best way forward. What would you say to him at that point?
Yeah, I would have tried to talk him out of it, just because I don't think that there's any ad that he could create or anyone could create that would break through the chaos of conflicting opinion, of conspiracy theory, of misinformation that exists out there. And so I would encourage him to use the money to get really grassroots, get really local. It's the equivalent of, you know, to use terms that he might understand, it's a political campaign where you have to get local people on your side and go out and stump in person and make your case. You know, instead of buying an $80,000 Ford F-150 and essentially raffling it off. By the way, I read that the guy who won it didn't even want it because of the tax implications of winning that. But instead of doing that, put all the money into recruiting local influencers, people who are community influencers at the local level, the local priest or the local head of the Rotary Club or the guy who owns the local diner. I don't know who they are. It'll be different in every community, but we have to get to those people, get them on side, show them incontrovertible facts about the efficacy of the vaccine and try to convince them to spread the word in their own community. That's the only thing that I think could work. The only other idea I can think of, honestly, is trying to get Facebook and Twitter on side to help distribute like real vaccine information. I think that's a lost cause. I don't think they'll come to the table because all they care about is engagement and they get more by spreading outrageous lies about the vaccine.
Ty Montague says Madison Avenue cannot come to the rescue. And like West Virginia pharmacy owner Lynn Fruth, he believes the only remedy for our current situation is ground level action.
It's notable to me that in addition to Governor Justice, Donald Trump himself is now pro-vax. Like he is saying you need to get it and you'd be crazy not to get it. And some of the crazier elements of the party are actually taking him on that topic. And so it's simply that, once again, we just don't know who to trust. And that now includes our greatest leaders, the people who we have entrusted our future to or the future direction of our republic to. That's why no ad in the world is going to solve that problem. It's a boots on the ground kind of problem. Like you got to get to the ground and you got to get with people and you got to convince them one at a time.
But that takes time.
It takes time and it takes money.
But at one point, it used to be that you could spend a jillion dollars on a Super Bowl ad and reach everybody, and all of a sudden, people buy Pepsi over Coke or something like that. You're saying we don't have that type of swing at the fences, silver bullet approach on this. That's not going to work.
Those days are over. That's over. Not going to happen.
Oh, those days are over for now. That's not going to happen in this environment. Maybe that'll happen again in the future, but for now, no.
I mean, I so hope that we heal this fracture and that we get back to a place of a sensible realization that we all share far more than we do not share, and that we need to start listening to each other and talking with each other in a civil way and being okay with the fact that we don't agree on some things. Civil discourse has gone out the window, and the vax hesitancy is one of the symptoms of that disease, and we have to solve that. When political discourse gets dark, I think a lot of people just take a step back and go, this is ugly. I'm going to wait this out. I'm not going to engage with this situation because it's just too fraught. And by the way, I'm busy. I have a job. I have a family. I need to look after them. And I'm going to wait for all of this craziness to just blow over. And then I'll decide what's true.
And so, at the end of our conversation with one of the most widely acknowledged creative geniuses on Madison Avenue, we are left with this. The best and only answer to our vaccine messaging woes is people talking to people.
What we need is to have people telling their friends, you need to get a vax. That's the mechanism by which we will turn this around. And so that's where I would be concentrated on thinking about this problem is, how do I get Trey to go tell all of his friends to get a vaccination? What is it that I need to do that? And I don't think it's a commercial. Look, I hope I'm wrong about this. I hope somebody comes up with a magic commercial that solves the problem. But I think the problem runs a little bit deeper.
There's a famous phrase from Canadian media philosopher Marshall McLuhan, who wrote, "The medium is the message." His point? When we hear a message, take in a point of view through any form of media, that information is shaped by when, where, and most importantly, how we hear it. The medium matters. Or to use more current terms, the platform becomes part of the message. According to McLuhan, a medium is not something neutral. It does something to people. It takes hold of them. In other words, it shapes what we see and sometimes what we are willing to believe and act on. The more media experts we spoke with about our public health vaccination campaign, the more it became clear. It's not really about the message anymore. It's about the medium. And the medium is us, you and me, not us and them. At this point, doctors and scientists have done their work and created multiple vaccines that can get us through this pandemic. Now, it's up to us. As Ty Montague put it, we need to be story doers, not storytellers. The only way to promote the vaccination effort is by actively reaching across the divides in our communities and creating trust. Trust in the science of medicine, and most importantly, trust in each other. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay, Brad Stratton, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to our friends at Mountain State Spotlight for their reporting about vaccination efforts in West Virginia. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Greater Kanawha Fund, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and the CRC Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.